The Growth and Future of Small Farms in Maine. When it comes to farming, Maine is bucking the national trends. Whereas the number of working farms is declining nationally, it's growing in Maine. And many of those farms are small farms run by young people. According to the UMaine Cooperative Extension, the number of farmers under 35 has increased 40% since 2007. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll talk about this trend in Maine agriculture. What kinds of opportunities and challenges do these small farmers face? How does the internet and the growth of farmers' markets affect their ability to make a living off the land? What kinds of choices do they face that perhaps earlier generations did not? We'll meet two young farmers and a farmer and educator who helps new farmers get going. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. For a lot of people, it is emblematic of the American dream to buy a farm and till the land. Recently, here in Maine, more and more people are actually doing it. Today, we'll meet a few of them and discuss small farms, how they are changing, and what it means for Maine. With me in the studio today, Amy Birchstead. She and her husband run the Buckwheat Blossom Farm in Wiscasset. Kelly Basin-Rupchand is the author of Birth, Death, and a Tractor, Connecting an Old Farm to a New Family. She and her husband are the owners of Pumpkin Vine Family Farm in Somerville. Daniel McPhee is also a farmer. He runs a farm in Palermo, and he is the education director at the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association, MOFCA. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you ever thought of becoming a farmer? Do you take advantage of what your local farm has to offer? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mpbn.net. You can send us a tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to all of you here today. And I'll start with you, Kelly. Congratulations on the book. And I want to hear from each of you one at a time, if it's okay, how you got into farming. What is your journey to open? I mean, all of you are young-ish, not a younger than the average farmer in Maine and in the U.S., which is 57 or 58 years old. How did you come to farming, Kelly?
I think I was born a farmer, although I wasn't born on a family farm. I would credit my first experience when I lived in Massachusetts. We went to Drumlin Farm Camp, which is still there and still attracts a lot of kids. And I think that must have brought out my early dreams. By the time I moved to Maine at 6 years old, we lived next door to a small family farm. And I somehow found there was an overgrown path, but I made my way through the path. And it was an old lobsterman and his wife, and they had a sheep farm. And my mom said that every day after school, she wouldn't know if I was home. She'd have to call the farm because I would head straight to the farm so I could be in time for chores. And I had this wonderful experience. It was totally magical. It's at that age when, you know, you want fairies and unicorns. And I had this farm. It was just really magical. And I think from that point on, when we eventually, a few years later, moved inland, I so much wanted to have a farm that when my dad went away on a conference, my mom helped me and we painted an old sheep shed and got some sheep and some chickens. And when he came back, we were officially a farm. So I think that since that point, I've been pursuing that dream. And I went on, my family believes in education. So when I decided I wanted to farm, I actually went to study agriculture. And from that point, I've just continued on this path.
Okay. Daniel, for you, was it as calculated a plan? Were you always going to be a farmer?
I was definitely not always going to be a farmer. For me, it was kind of a gradual thing. I was in graduate school for geology and really enjoyed that, but over the years started feeling more and more hyper-specialized in exactly what I did, which I loved. I loved doing the field work. I loved working with, you know, people in other countries, you know, except I started to realize that, you know, I was one of maybe 5 or 10 people in the world who really knew or cared about what I was working on. And at the same time, you know, I'd get home from the lab at 11 night, 2 in the morning, and wasn't even cooking my own food. You know, everything that I was doing, I wasn't really able to provide for myself, even though I was so good at one particular thing. And that led me to get more and more involved in issues of environmental public health things like that that applied to what I was doing research-wise, but felt more empowering on a personal basis and a community basis. And from that, I eventually left grad school and I started working on farms, decided that that's really what felt most important for me, to be able to provide for myself and my family. And it just went from there, working on a lot of different educational farms and now having our own farm in Maine and working for MAFCA.
How long ago did you make the jump?
2006 was my first apprenticeship. That's when I started.
Okay. And turning to you, Amy, what's your story? How did you come to be a farmer, a small farmer in Maine?
Well, similar to Kelly, I did have a lot of exposure to agriculture as a child. You know, a farmer hanging up the road who would pick up us kids in his hay trailer as he went by, and just a lot of joy in that. Also, my mother always had a large garden and did a lot of canning and freezing of food, so I grew up on healthy food and really have always known and felt the immense value of that as well. And I have just a love of animals and working outside. I never thought that I would become a farmer, though. I was always keenly aware of the kind of scary economic position you could be in as a small farmer, you know, based on climates and markets and whatnot. So I always thought that I'd probably homestead and have a job or something like that. My junior year of college, I went on a study abroad trip and spent the whole school year traveling around the world to 8 different countries and stayed in a lot of small villages. And I saw firsthand how essential it is for people to have control of their food source and access to land and to maintain the knowledge of growing their own food. So I came back to this country. I'm really passionate about how important it was for people to realize where their food is coming from and know something about how to grow it themselves. And then I met my husband, Jeff, who's just one of those people that was born to be a farmer. He's got the energy for it, the body for it, the brain for it. He just loves working the land and managing a piece of land for the benefit of his family and community and the world, really. We take our responsibility as stewards of the land very seriously, and creating nutritious food is a huge goal for us. And he did go through the MAFCA, the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. He went through their apprenticeship program and was one of their first journey people. And then after that, did a good job of just connecting with other local farmers to learn from them and finding his own mentors. And we're also a horse-powered farm, so he's learned from...
And why did you decide to do that, be a horse-powered farm?
Well, my husband would say, well, I'm not a good mechanic, so...
And what's the truth?
Oh, there's a lot of long answers, as you know, you can imagine. You definitely, you know, the environmental impact of, you know, not using fossil fuels and whatnot. Also, startup costs are a lot lower. It's a lot easier to buy a team of horses and find some old equipment on your neighbor's old stone wall and put it to use than it is to purchase a new tractor. But also the joy of the work. You know, we don't make much money farming, so we got to enjoy our days and do it in a way that can involve our kids. And for us, that is horse farming. We like the pace. We like the interaction with the animals. And it's kinder on the soil than chopping it up with a tiller and the implements we use with the horses.
Amy, you mentioned, you know, going in with eyes wide open, knowing how difficult it is to make it as a farmer. So I'm going to pose to you and to the other panelists, why farm? I mean, no health insurance, no job security. It seems pretty daunting.
Well, now we have health insurance thanks to Obamacare. It is. It is daunting. And I've always, I've often had another source of income myself, or had my finger on another source of income or feelers out for one. I've done different jobs in the past, which I enjoy doing. I'm not the kind of person who needs to be 100% farmer. Or like my husband, that's what he was born to do.
So, Kelly, what about you? Why farm? What is it that's so important to you to have this be your life's work?
I feel such a complete connection. I always thought I wanted to farm, and like Amy, I was in a more academic path, and I don't think I could have made the leap without my husband, because he actually has mechanical skills, so we have some old tractors and stuff. But once we made this leap, I mean, I always thought I wanted to do it, but when I was actually living it, I realized I never felt so alive as when I was outside working the land. Still to this day, I'll be inside and I step outside and it's like I just come fully alive. And when I'm working the soil or working with the animals on a very personal level, I feel so connected. I feel I would farm one way or the other if, you know, there is it's a hard financial stake, and I do worry every day, and I worry if I'm taking a risk with my family's future. But for me personally, there's really no other way I could, you know, we have this life, and I choose to live as fully as I can, and I'm every day trying to figure out how to make that possible for the future. And I believe that a lot of people come to it for that reason, because at this point, there's so many things against that work against farming and being a small farmer, and yet people keep coming to do it. And I believe there's a joy in it that keeps drawing us. And we keep looking to make it easier. We would sure like to make it easier and have more time to relax and actually sit and look at the fields we work so hard in, and, you know, hold our children's hand while we're sitting, and, you know, and get to take a holiday. But the joy in the work is so huge that that's reward.
And Daniel, I'm going to ask you personally, why farm? But then also, what do you hear from those people who come to you in the classes that you've taught both at KVCC and now at MOFCA? What are you hearing from people over and over again? Is it the same story that Kelly's telling, that they want to be connected with the land, they want to do something fulfilling?
I very much think so. And it seems like this newest wave of young and other beginning agrarians in the state and throughout the country, it's largely fueled by a strong sense of social or environmental values and ethic. And the economic piece is kind of, it's a difficult piece of that puzzle that isn't yet resolved for a lot of folks. And I think you see that in the statistics of small farms in Maine. A lot of folks are doing it because it feels so important. It's so empowering. It's such a wholesome way to raise your family and exist within your community. But as of now, the way the food system is set up and the way that things go in the state and in this country, it's really hard to do that in a way that actually can support your entire family solely off the farm.
Do you find that many people who have small farms, also at least one member of the couple is doing a job outside of the farm?
Yes, that is definitely true. The majority of farms in Maine have at least one person working off-farm part-time, generally more than that.
And I think that Amy made an important point when she said we have health insurance now because of Obamacare, because mm-hmm. of the ACA. Do you predict that because of that, there will be more people who are willing to take the jump and maybe leave that, you know, more traditional job and take the risk and start a farm? You all, two of you are nodding.
Yes.
Yeah, you think so?
Definitely for us. I mean, my husband was working off farm full time because we had health insurance and two small kids. And so being able to get it through Obamacare and get health insurance, I mean, he said this is huge. This is a revolution. I mean, people can work for themselves now.
So 10 years, 20 years from now, what do you expect to see in Maine? Daniel. Stop looking at each other.
I mean, I know what we all hope to see, and I know what the numbers are telling us. We're increasing the number of farms in the state quite rapidly, actually, and much more than any other, you know, place in the country. And so that's extremely positive. What I want to see is more of these farms able to succeed beyond those initial beginning years when we're all working off of our passions and able to maybe get by without the income that we actually need or without the healthcare that we need. And then after, you know, 3 years, 5 years, as you become a more established business, you realize, you know, my body isn't working so well, my bank account is empty and I've maxed out my credit cards, or I can't get access to the amount of land that I need to make my business viable. And I feel that that's the place where we really need to do a lot of work as a community to make sure that those farmers who do come into this very important work for all of us are able to succeed in the long run, not just as beginners.
I'm sure there are a lot of strategic decisions to be made when you're running a farm, starting a farm. And I'm guessing that one of them is, What kind of farm do I want to be? Do I want to grow a variety of crops and sell them at the farmer's market? Do I want to specialize in something that's high priced and people will pay a premium for? Do I want to sell locally, or do I want to try to market my goods to restaurants in New York City? How do you think about those decisions, Kelly? Have you thought about those at your farm, the Pumpkin Vine Family Farm?
We thought about them intensely before we even decided to buy a farm. You have to love it, but you also have to be a hard-headed businessman if you're going to survive in this most difficult of economic ventures. So you have to pay attention to the market. And I think right now we're in a really exciting, although it's very hard, I think this is the time if small farms are ever going to make it, I think this is the time, because there is a changing consumer demand for local food. And people are starting to realize the true value of food and are willing to pay a higher price for that. And I think that, you know, this is the moment. So if we can get the support systems in place, we can do it. So we looked at both what we like to do and what had a high value. We felt that, for instance, in our case, making cheese in the long run, you know, my husband loves to work with animals. I love crafting. The Maine Cheese Guild is a great support network. Maine Cheese is getting known nationally, and it's a high value, a value-added crop. So, you know, it makes sense. It has higher economic return than just selling our milk, for instance. We also look at, so right now we're very much in the transition stage, as Daniel talked about. Our farm's future is very much in the balance right now. Anything could happen. But we look at what can we do seasonally also to give us some income. The goat dairy tends to taper off towards the fall, so you need something in the winter. So we're looking at different crops. And the really fun and interesting part is the farm that I profile in the book, we are actually have come around to doing a lot of the same activities that the farmer before us did and the farmer before him, because that is both what the land offers mm-hmm. and the niches that are there seasonally. So he had a cow dairy. We have a goat dairy. In the winter, he used to sell Christmas trees. Well, a lot of those, there was a few, you know, some 30 years between us. A lot of those trees are overgrown, but we're now using the wreath brush to make wreaths. He did firewood and timber. We're also re-grooming the overgrown lots and doing firewood and timber. So you look at what the land has to offer. You look at, it has to be something you love. And you have to also try things. A lot of farmers, when we were first starting out, told us, start small. So we're trying different things to see how it fits. You know, like we're doing some bulbs for Fedco because I love plants, but I can't manage a CSA garden that needs attention every day if I'm also making cheese. So bulbs have a window of time when you need to work a lot. You have to look at your labor requirements throughout the year and kind of fit it. So it takes a lot of planning. You do have to love it, but you do have to be a hard-nosed businessman to some part.
Okay, so Amy, I want to find out how you made those decisions, but we do have to take a break. So I'll ask you that afterwards. We'll also take your comments and questions after the break. The phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send us an email at talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. This is Maine Calling.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by the Central Maine Heart and Vascular Institute, offering quality care for your heart, from the heart, close to home. Learn more at cmhvi.org. Dean Wealth Advisors, independent investment advice to individuals, families, and institutions, DEIGHAN.com. And Androscoggin Bank's Main Street Foundation, now accepting applications for the 25K for Kids Award, mainstreet-foundation.org. MPBN is a media sponsor for the annual Maine International Film Festival, which is now underway in Waterville and runs until Sunday, July 19th. The festival features a diverse offering of films and a chance to meet many of the craftspeople behind the efforts. Over 100 films are being featured. MPBN members are once again entitled to a discount on tickets to the festival, and we have complete information, including a link to the schedule, online at mpbn.net. Click on Events.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Small Farming in Maine. In the studio with me, three farmers, Kelly Payson Roopchand and her husband, are the owners of Pumpkin Vine Family Farm in Somerville. Kelly is also the author of the new book, Birth, Death, and a Tractor, Connecting an Old Farm to a new family. Daniel McPhee is the education director at MOFCA and also runs a farm in Palermo. Amy Birchstead and her husband run the Buckwheat Blossom Farm in Wiscasset. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Amy, before the break, we were talking about the kind of strategic decisions you have to make to be a small farm. You obviously can't do everything. How have you thought about that over the years, and what do you specialize in now?
Well, currently we specialize in pasture-raised lamb and all assortment of wool products, including socks, wool comforters covered with organic cotton, yarn, and raw hand-spinning fleeces. We also do eggs from hens on pasture-fed organic grain and an assortment of vegetables focusing on winter vegetables. We do two winter farmers markets because my husband shears sheep in the spring. Back to kind of Kelly's talking about planning out the year and what works when, we found that he is on the road March through beginning of July still. He's shearing sheep all over the state. So we can't do much for summer production and early production. So we focus more on winter market. But when we started with some wholesale vegetable accounts and doing a meat CSA where people could order, you know, a half a cow, a pig, you know, any assortment of things from us. And that was a good way to start because there is flexibility and forgiveness in wholesale sales. If you don't have something, they can buy it from somebody else. Not a lot of pressure. We were very ambitious, so we soon started farmers markets and started a big summer CSA and a big winter CSA on land that we were leasing. We got a Farms for the Future grant, which is a huge help to farmers in the state to help us build root crop storage facility for the winter CSA and do other improvements to be able to pull off these CSAs. And you really don't know sometimes what something's like till you jump into it. And there's a lot of pressure involved with doing a CSA, a lot of people counting on you, which for some people works out fine. For us, it just tended to be too much pressure and too much stress. So we realize that we much prefer the farmer's market model where, again, if you don't have cucumbers, no one's upset with you. They can go to the next stand and buy cucumbers. And we find we have a lot of personal relationships there, too. So it's been a lot of trial and error for us and, you know, maturing and getting to know yourself and what you do and don't like to do and what sacrifices you'll make. But I suggest to somebody just getting out, starting out farming, that apprenticing is a really great way to learn what you think you'd like to do and not like to do. You can read a book about running a CSA and think, oh my God, that sounds so awesome. And then you work on a CSA farm and be like, oh my God, look at the stress of trying to pull together the share of the second week. I don't think I'd want to do that. You know, so really, there's so many interesting books to read about agriculture, but the way to really learn is a combination of reading and getting out there and doing it and see what works for you and what doesn't. And it's great to learn that on somebody else's dime as opposed to your own. And to be an apprentice for a bit.
And Daniel, you're smiling. What do you tell your students about this whole idea of thinking about how to be a farmer and how to be a strategically smart farmer?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do so much with where your interests are, but also it has to do so much with where you end up being located, what your piece of land is like, what your community is like, and then also what your personal level of interest with direct to consumer marketing is. Some people really love going to farmers markets and having that personal interaction with all of their customers, and other people really honestly would rather just stay on their farm, grow cases of lettuce and have it go off to a wholesaler, because that's the way that they operate personally. And I think of the apprenticeship model as just such a wonderful way to start gathering those tools and those experiences so you know What is it like to run a CSA? What's involved in a highly diversified operation? What does it look like to raise animals or other more specialty crops or value-added products? You get to see all of these different things, maybe on the farm where you're working, maybe on other farms that you're visiting throughout the season, so that when you're ready to start your own operation, you'll know what speaks to you and also what's going to work for where you're located. My family in particular, my wife and I both had backgrounds in working in highly diversified vegetable operations, but we knew when we moved to Maine that we were going to live in a quite rural place and that a lot of the direct-to-consumer markets were pretty well satisfied. And so we started looking to wholesale, and we grow grafted fruit trees, we grow organic seed crops. They're things that that have a much more punctuated season, like Kelly's bulbs, so that we can be doing those things while also working off farm. And you find out what works for you economically, but also just time-wise with everything you have to do.
Okay, we're going to go to the callers now, and we have John calling from Edgecombe. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I just want to thank you young people for doing what you do. It's hard work, and you don't often get what you need to get from it. But my family's been here in Maine for 200 years, and we wouldn't have survived without farms. And as a child, I didn't grow up on a farm, but Daddy and Mama always had a big garden. And you pick the stones out in the spring, and you plant, and you weed. And then there's tomatoes, and then there's potatoes in the fall. And I just want to thank you young people for taking the initiative. Growing local, eating local, that's what we should do. That's what we've always done here in Maine. And the big corporations want us to buy fruit and vegetables out of season from other places, and bless the people that work for that. But I just want to thank you so much for keeping the Maine tradition alive of family farms. Thank you.
Well, John, thanks for your call.
Thank you so much, John. And I'm close to tears here because the farm that I wrote about in my book and that we're now reviving, the last generation of that family, which farmed for six generations since the early 1800s, 200 years, he passed away this spring. But the farm has been a community center, and we've realized how much it has been because as we start to fix the windows, we hear from the townsfolk, hey, thanks for fixing the windows. The farm looks great. And, you know, I used to work there and help Don. And I think that this tremendous social and community value of farms is one of the richnesses and resources that we need to stress to help people realize why we need to preserve them. A small farm is not a large farm for many reasons. And one of the reasons is that it gives people a chance to directly experience nature, the cycles of life. I just saw, I heard on MPBN a few minutes ago, an advertisement from MIF, and there's an amazing film I have to put a plug for here. It's called After Winter, Spring. I just had a chance to meet with a director, and it's showing again on Friday. And it's the story of small farms in France, their current situation as they struggle after 2,000 years of continuous cultivation. They're facing the same issues of, will there be a next generation of small farms and can they continue? And I think it's a really crucial question. And I think that experience, one of the farmers on there, Nanu, she said she must have been in her 60s or 70s or 80s. I don't know. She looked timeless. And she said, farms allow people a tactile relationship with the earth. And I think that tactile relationship is something we're missing more and more in this increasingly technological world. And someone once said to me, well, small farms are irrelevant because today's world is technological. And I would start at the same place, today's world is technological, and say farms are therefore more relevant than ever because we need to have that opportunity to experience nature in this world we live in. And I see such a hunger for it. We're having a farm camp next week, and we have campers coming from California, campers coming from Jamaica. I just think that there is a place for it, and small farms have so much value for their food, for their local economic impact, for their environmental sustainability, but I think it's also a huge community and personal resource. So I'm glad we can continue that tradition. As I said, our farm's future is still in the balance, but we will do everything we can to continue it for you, John, and for everyone else.
Amy.
And Kelly, you were telling me earlier that that film about France, the small farmers were struggling partially because of a change in the subsidy
yes.
structure. And you had asked earlier about what we think small farms will look like years and years down the road. And I feel like a lot of us couldn't really answer that question because a lot of it really depends on the political scene, who our governor is, who our president is, what lobbyists they're listening to, what corporations they're listening to, and what our subsidy structure looks like in this country currently. Large farms get large subsidies. They keep the cost of food artificially low, which is a problem not just for farmers in this country, but internationally. And there, you know, we've all talked about how hard it is to make a living farming, and there's a gap between what we have to pay to produce this food and what we can charge to sell it. We need to be able to charge more for this food to be able to make a living doing it. And we can't do that under the current political and economical climate. So there has to be some major policy work done in order to enable small farms to survive.
We're going to go to Jonesboro and Margie. Hi, Margie.
Hi. Oh, goodness. I didn't think I was going to call, but this is great. The farmers made this country. Everyone needs good food to survive. And I can't believe it. Everyone could have a small pot, snap peas, spinach, tomatoes, or lycopene. Parsley is good for the kidneys. And I had ducks and turkeys. I ate the eggs. And I have apples and blackberry bushes. But you know what? You guys, you farmers, don't have to go to a gym and pay for it. You get so much exercise to be healthy. And then you sleep good, too, and you eat good. So I'm telling you, one, you're the best. That's all I want to say.
Well, you guys are garnering compliments on Maine Calling today. Thanks, Margie, for calling. We'll head to Peru and James. Hi, James. Go ahead.
Hi there. James Thurston. We have a small farm in Peru, Maine. It's called Thurston Family Farm. It's multi-generational. My grandfather started it back in the 40s, and we've been trying to work it ever since then. And we've been doing pretty well. But what I would like to talk about mostly is over in rural Maine, we're in Oxford County, and it's harder to make a living, I think, out here doing farming. We started a CSA operation not too long ago, and it's just been bare ever since. We have to take a step back from that, and I think a lot of it is because of the location where we are and also the amount of small and young farmers there are moving to the area versus the population that is here willing to buy the kind of food.
And you're nodding. I think that Daniel found that in Palermo, that was part of why you decided not to be selling locally, right?
Definitely. I think that's the experience generally for a lot of new farmers, whether they're young, whether they're not young. We're moving into a state, into an industry where obviously there's not enough good, healthy food for everybody in the state, but the distribution networks that support small farms are not here in a way that is totally functional yet. And I think that's a place that we need to do a lot more work so that we can access a lot more of this farmland that is away from our large population centers and start thinking about business models that don't rely on the very high margins that you get with direct-to-consumer products, because a lot of us are living in rural communities, and we should be. Those rural communities need their small farms, and in order to have those small farms, they need to have ways for those farmers to get their product to markets.
So, James, do you feel as though the problem is that the proportion of farms to population, there's just saturation, and really the population can't support a certain number of farms? Do you find it's that the people who live in your area can't afford the high price of some of your products, or is it the price of gas to coming, say, to the Portland farmers market is too expensive and takes too much time out of your operation?
Well, I guess I'd say D, all of the above. I think in our area, there's a lot of people that like the type of life that farming offers. But then you go to the farmer's market, and there's just nobody there, you know, and it's very hard. I stopped going to farmer's market about 2 or 3 years ago, and there were a couple of days where I made like $40 a day. I was like, I just can't do it. I can't stand there all day and only make that much. And I do think the population is dwindling in Oxford County, too, so that offers its own hurdles as well. And then gas, as far as going, you know, trucking down to Portland is a deal, but at the same time, I'm not the only person that's thinking about going farther south in Maine to sell my produce, and I think the competition is just so crazy down there that it's I almost don't even think about it as far as that goes. And we are more looking into wholesale now instead of the private market.
All right. Well, thanks for calling and sharing your perspective. I think this is probably the biggest issue small farmers in Maine face right now is what you talked about. Daniel, I've heard this over the years that we don't really have the systems in place to support the small farms. You guys are all kind of figuring it out on your own.
I think that's definitely true, though it's important also to be thankful that Maine does still have the the rural infrastructure, agricultural support infrastructure that it does still have, where so many other states throughout the country and throughout New England lost so much more of that infrastructure. And I think that that's the existence of those relic systems is what is drawing a lot of beginning and new farmers to Maine, because even though it's not perfect, it's still a lot better. The community is so strong and so supportive that folks really have the trust that we're going to figure it out. And there's a lot of organizations working to that end. There's a lot of state government agencies that are working to that end. And I think things are changing. And as we see direct markets get more and more saturated, I think a lot of the movement is towards scaling up and towards wholesale and towards aggregation and distribution. I think that's the new front for a lot of beginning farmers.
Well, believe it or not, we have to take another short break. When we return, we'll get to more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by the law offices of Joe Bornstein, a team of over 65 professionals representing injured and disabled Mainers statewide, joebornstein.com, and Casella, committed to improving Maine's air quality through the conversion of landfill gas to energy. Casella, giving resources new life.
On the next Fresh Air, medical marijuana. Is it effective? If so, for what symptoms? And is it safe? We talk with Dr. David Kasseret about his new book, Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. He directs the Hospice and Palliative Care Program at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. Join us.
And we invite you to join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. And join us at 1 o'clock following Maine Calling for the Commonwealth Club of California. Today's guest is author Judy Bloom. That's the Commonwealth Club of California, coming up immediately following Maine Calling at 1 o'clock here on MPBN Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the programming, the challenges of being a small farmer in Maine. In the studio with me, Daniel McPhee. He's the education director at MOFCA, also runs a small farm in Palermo. Kelly Payson Roopchand is the author of Birth, Death, and a Tractor, Connecting an Old Farm to a New Family. She and her husband are the owners of Pumpkin Vine Family Farm in Somerville. And Amy Birchstead and her husband run the Buckwheat Blossom Farm in Wiscasset. Join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Helen, who's calling from Kennebunk. Hi, Helen. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm an almost 80-year-old lady who moved up here when we retired from New York State. And I just can't help, as I listen, to see that we're almost working in a cycle. I grew up on a farm where I was the seventh generation, but I was an only child, so there was no brother to succeed me. And my father made the decision to not employ additional help on the farm except in the summer after World War II, when it wasn't easy to get help. And so he and my mother made a decent living. It wasn't enough to have sent me to college without the fact that New York State had some good scholarships in place. But I didn't marry a farmer, and I always have been grateful, because I could not have taken the stress that all of you take. But I was thrilled when I saw organics come in, because I felt that people were willing to pay that higher price, and this could help make a decent living. So I commend you very much.
All right. Thanks for your call, Helen. We have another call from Kennebunk, which I believe is related. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Well, thanks so much for taking my call. The first time I've ever called in, but I was so appreciative of the topic because it strikes close to home. My son, who turns 30 this year, has been farming for 5 years, not in Maine. He's in southern New Hampshire, but so many of the issues being raised are so familiar to me from talking with him. And in particular, I just wondered if there were any ideas about the viability of lobbying for some of that subsidy money that's currently going to the large farms. how about some of that going to small farmers so they don't have to raise their prices, but can sell? And I assume that what those subsidies do to keep the price at the market low is that they go directly to the farmers. So I'd be interested in any thoughts or comments of whether anybody thinks that would be worth pursuing. Thanks so much.
So on the federal level, this is really through the Farm Bill, right, that just passed within the last year.
That's definitely true. There's so much money out there already at the federal level to support various different aspects of agriculture. You know, we hear the millions and billions of dollars that are going to agriculture, but the reality is a very tiny portion of that actually makes its way to any of the types of farms that we're talking about here. Even vegetable operations, the vegetables are considered a specialty crop. So I actually just got back from a meeting in Washington, D.C. with a number of other representatives from federal agencies as well as organizations across the country who are running some of the best new farmer training projects. And much of what we talked about was how we can better organize at a federal level to access a lot of these existing programs that beginning farmers are entitled to, but not yet actually participating in for various different structural reasons and just for reasons of, you know, simple policies that could be put in place if we had more of a voice at a federal level. So I think that it's really important work. And the same thing is happening in the state of Maine. We're a really good example that was looked to at that same meeting because we have such a coordinated group of service providers within the state through the Beginning Farmer Resource Network that basically provides a clearinghouse for anybody interested in getting into farming or support once they are farming or if they are a landholder and want to lease their land to a beginning farmer or they are a farmer who wants to retire, provides support for all those things. And it's a place where all of our organizations, MOFCA and Land for Good and the Maine Farmland Trust and the Department of Agriculture and NRCS, all of these programs, we come together to make sure that we all know what each other are doing, what programs are available, and make sure that we have a coordinated approach so that when beginning farmers need support, we're ahead of that and we're actually reaching out to them to make sure that their businesses will become viable because that's the future of agriculture in Maine. If we want to be feeding ourselves, we need to be making sure that the beginning farmers are going to be successful in the long run.
Is there a webpage for the Beginning Farmer Resource Network? Yes, there is. So we will provide a link for that on our MPBN Maine Calling Facebook page. Do any of you receive subsidies for the work that you do?
No.
No, everybody's shaking their head. Going to Mark in Alna. Mark, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I'm calling from Alma, and my wife and I have just relocated to Alma. And I like what this gentleman said, the caller just before, and I can't stress enough, I guess, about looking at the big picture on the political scene where whether it's focusing on a small business, craft business, or farm, food production. I think it's incumbent on Washington to support small business. And part of that is through a national health care system, taking the health care monkey off people's backs so that they can concentrate on the things that are important and they enjoy doing. We've also spent a couple of trips my wife and I protesting, how do I put it, against Monsanto, I'll put that out there, and the right to know what's in your food. That's been very growth and important for us, and can't stress that whole thing anymore. We saw Bernie Sanders in Portland, last week, and he hit on a number of key issues that empower the taxpayer person.
Well, thank you very much for your call, Mark. We have a similar email from from Maya in Newburgh. She writes, she's talking about the role of the governor and state government. Is there a place that you all look to, another state that has got policies that help small farmers in a way that you think Maine should be moving? Not really.
I don't know as far as a state, but I mean, I can speak to this movie I just saw about France, and the problem the French farmers are now facing is that they did all used to be subsidized, the large farmers and the small farmers, and that enabled the small farmers to exist. And the problem now is with joining the EU, they have had to remove, to be fair to farmers, small farmers in the within the union, they've had to remove the subsidies for the small farmers, and the small farmers without that subsidy again cannot, you know, compete with the price, and they're looking at a very uncertain future. So I don't know anywhere else here in the state. I don't know if Daniel in D.C. heard about it, but
I mean, to be honest, as imperfect as we may see the situation in Maine, Maine and also Vermont are often looked to as states with more progressive and supportive policies for small agriculture than other states. There's definitely a lot of improvement that could be made, but I think part of that is we have such a small population, and our legislators are willing to listen. Doesn't matter what party they're from, they understand what it means to live in a rural state that depends on agriculture, the value of that to the community. And so if they get five calls from constituents about an important issue, they're going to listen and will act on it. And I find that really empowering.
What are some of the policies that Maine has that are not found in other states and help small farmers like you?
Well, I think, I mean, again, the example of the Beginning Farmer Resource Network, it's not a policy. A lot of, I guess that's part of the scary part of this. Many of these things aren't institutionalized. They're not formal policies. They're based on the goodwill and the personal relationships that we have between service providers, between farmers, between neighbors, that, you know, this is an important value to us to support small-scale agriculture in the state. And so we work really hard to make sure that those programs that are there are accessed by everybody and supporting everybody.
Okay, we're going to go to Steve in Gorham. Hi, Steve, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm a professional farmer here, and I am excited to be growing a farm, having started this new farm business in 2011. And thankful for the opportunity to maybe contribute something briefly.
Do you have a comment or question?
Well, I would like to know what the what your guests think about this. My experience coming to Maine in about 10 years ago to farm was that there was a price expectation among both customers and farmers that was, I'd say, about 60% of what it was throughout other parts of New England. And as I've pushed the pencil on what enterprises would be successful, it's been really hard to find something that hasn't already been, you know, artificially depressed by those price expectations. You know, if we're going to scale up production without losing the local touch, for many enterprises, it just seems like it can't be done. So I've actually moved out of vegetables toward you pick fruit and other enterprises such as that, where we can really seem to have a hope of making a living without having, you know, forever an outside income having to come in to support it.
Do you all find that? Do you find that there's a price expectation that's unrealistic here that you might not be facing in other states?
Well, I don't know about other states, but certainly, as he said, penciling out the numbers, and as we've all experienced, the numbers just don't add up often, and that's why you have to have outside income. And where we're at now, we've been farming for 14 years, and a lot of our peers in the agriculture community are starting to take a hard look at it and making a change. Perhaps they used to be a diversified farm, and now they're going just to one crop and hiring Mexicans to help make the numbers meet up. There are sacrifices we have to make, philosophical sacrifices, you know, to make those numbers meet up and to continue growing food for our local economy, for a local community. Being a small, diverse farm is, I think, the most challenging because you don't have that economy of scale. You know, sometimes you really do need to get bigger and more focused and look more at a single or two crops to be able to make it work. But that is such a shame because a lot of the values to a community do lie in these small, diversified farms, ones that can produce lots of different crops for the local community, but also that can change with changing market demands and changing climate demands. We're looking at global climate change. It's here, it's happening, and it's threatening our food source. And it's going to be those small farms that really know how to tend the soil and can discover which seed varieties are working best in our new climate, which can deal with the drought or the rains or whatever it may be that comes our way. So these small farms are going to be what helps us survive into the future. So we got to find a way for them to make a living so they can survive now so we can survive into the future.
Steve, thanks for your call, and thanks to all of you for being here today. Amy Birchstead and her husband run the Buckwheat Blossom Farm in Wiscasset. Kelly Basin Roopchand and her husband are the owners of Pumpkin Vine Family Farm in Somerville. She is also the author of a new book, Birth, Death, and a Tractor, Connecting an Old Farm to a New Family. Daniel McPhee is the education director at MOFCA. He also runs a farm in Palermo. John Keimel ran the board today. Our volunteer, Cindy Hahn, answered your calls and produced the program. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith, and the program, don't forget, now repeats at midnight. Tomorrow on Maine Calling, join me for a conversation about the evolving relationship between the United States and Russia. And one more thing, later this month, we're going to do a program on the different dialects found here in Maine, and we're hoping you'll take part. If you, a family member, a friend, or neighbor use an expression only found here, record it using your smartphone, computer, or tablet, and then email it to us at dialects@mpbn.net. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.